with his Armenian counterpart in 2019, which was followed later by Indian External Affairs Minister's visit to Yerevan in 2022. Armenia is also the largest recipient of India's development assistance. On the contrary, there have been no foreign delegation visits between India, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Armenia and Azerbaijan are members of the International North-South Transport Corridor, of which New Delhi is a part. India has also been supporting Yerevan's proposal to include Chabahar Port in INSDC. For now, India's assessment is that bilateral trade with Armenia is bound to benefit once a free trade agreement between India and the Eurasian Economic Union, currently under negotiations, gets concluded.
Azerbaijan has been pushing to establish the Zangezur Corridor project, a proposed transport corridor that would link it to the Nakhchivan Autonomous Region, a western exclave of Azerbaijan, separated from the rest of the country by Armenian territory. The proposed Zangezur Corridor is also part of a larger transportation project connecting Baku to Istanbul in European Turkey. However, India has been opposing the project as the Iran-Armenian border provides New Delhi access to the Persian Gulf and the Black Sea, circumventing the Suez Canal and bypassing Azerbaijan, with which India shares lukewarm ties.
Armenia is interested in deeper cooperation with India as both the countries share similar geopolitical goals. On the other hand, Azerbaijan and Pakistan form an increasingly close partnership. Islamabad does not recognize Armenia officially, thus fostering close relationship with Baku. Yerevan has been in conflict with Baku over Nagorno-Karabakh. This broader geopolitical setting explains Armenia's efforts to build closer military, technological, and generally diplomatic relations with India. In recent years, there have been important breakthrough agreements on defense supplies from India to Armenia. According to foreign policy experts, the common interests of New Delhi and Yerevan could be the reason behind the decision by the Armenian government to grant India a $40 million deal to supply 4 India-produced weapon-locating radars to Armenia. The Zangezur Corridor has been actively opposed by the Indian government, which sees it as an obstacle to its access to the north. The worry is that if Armenia loses its land connection with Iran, India's ambitious plan for reaching Europe via the INSDC will be imperiled. Maintaining strong ties with Armenia, Iran has been against a project which it thinks could have consequences for Russia and China as well. For India, Iran plays an important role in its connectivity projects to link Central Asia and Europe. In view of New Delhi's alignment with Tehran and Yerevan, the opposition to Zangezur Corridor will almost certainly persist with its current foreign policy.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by senior fellow and head of West Asia and Central Asia Tillotoma Foundation, Ms. Meena Singh Roy from Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Miss. Now, the ties between India and Armenia have been growing in recent years, with the two countries engaging even in an arms trade deal. So the question is New Delhi trying to fill in the Russian vacuum for Yerevan?
Well, if we look at India's relations with the Caucasian countries, and particularly Armenia, they've been growing, as you said. But this is not to replace Russia or any other country. I think India has always built its relations with an individual country based on its own national interest, based on, you know, its foreign policy goals. And that is what is happening when we look at India-Armenia relations. For past few years, you know, you must have noticed that India's relations with Armenia have grown many folds. And particularly the main pillar of its relationship is also the defense cooperation, which we see growing today. And India was the, you know, it recognized, Armenia's independence. And since then, you know, after 1991, it's the relationship has been growing, but not at the pace which it has grown in past few years. So it also, you know, reflects the geopolitical changes which are happening globally and regionally. So it is not to replace Russia or any other country, but to sort of maintain relations based on its own strengths.
Mrs. Singh Roy, the region also meets India's demands of oil, gas, minerals, and etc. So how do you see the relation between India and the South Caucasus states evolving in the coming years?
Actually, if you look at the region, India's ties with Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, mainly, you know, its ties have grown with Armenia. As far as the oil, gas, and other resources are concerned, you know, Armenia doesn't have the resources, but India has invested in Azerbaijan, the ONGC. But it is not the main source of, you know, India's energy imports. The major, you know, energy demands of India are met from the Gulf region. So from that point of view, I would say Armenia is the only country with which India has grown its relations in past few years. But if we look at Azerbaijan or Georgia, they are not that important. Yet it is, but in future, I think, you know, the changes would be happening, but the focus would still continue to be on Armenia. That is what I can foresee. It is not to deny the fact that India would not grow its ties with Azerbaijan and Georgia, but Armenia would remain the key pillar of bilateral cooperation in the region.
Mr. Singh Roy, India has been opposing the construction of the Zangezur corridor, being on the same page with Iran. So to what extent will the construction of the corridor impact India's interests in the region?
If we look at, you know, India's past relations with the region, India has invested heavily in building the infrastructure, you know, connectivity issues in that sense. But as far as the corridor, Zangezur corridor is concerned, you know, it is for the two countries to decide what they want. And there are issues and the problems when we are talking about the corridor. First of all, even Armenia and Azerbaijan, you know, are not on the same page. Armenia doesn't, I mean, yes, there was an agreement signed after the war, which talks about, you know, acceptance of the building of corridor. But Armenia and Azerbaijan themselves, you know, there is an issue between two of them. And as far as India is concerned, I think for India, the International North-South Transport Corridor is a key to connecting, you know, India via Iran to Central Asia and beyond. So this is what India would be very much keen to see, you know, these countries being Iran, particularly Iran, Russia, Armenia, part of the International North-South Transport Corridor. So what two countries would do between themselves is not something which I guess India would be looking at. But yes, India's focus is going to be more on the International North-South Transport Corridor, on building infrastructure in cooperation with Iran. So that is what I guess is going to be the focus of India.
Last but not least, Miss, Azerbaijan's close ties with Pakistan have not been taken well by India. The establishment of the corridor will lead to greater influence of Pakistan and Turkey in the region. So to what degree will it affect the growing interest of New Delhi in the South Caucasus?
Let me put it, you know, the answer in the following manner. Number one, you said that how, you know, Pakistan's cooperation with Azerbaijan and Turkey's, you know, involvement in that and their position, you know, generally on Kashmir has been a problematic issue. And that would continue to remain as far as India is concerned. Because India doesn't believe that Kashmir is an issue which needs to be to be advertised, you know, in these forums, and it is a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan, and they have to solve it. Secondly, for India, I think, you know, maintaining bilateral ties with most of the countries is an important factor. If you look at the way India has helped Turkey after the earthquake happened, India was the first country to offer the humanitarian help to Turkey. So I believe India pursues its foreign policy based on its own values, which it has followed in past, and it will continue to do so. And in this respect, India has also helped Pakistan. So when, you know, there is a difference of opinion or something which is inimical to India's national interest, India will object to it. But as far as building corridors and infrastructure development is concerned, these are long-term, you know, developmental projects which the countries would do or they would cooperate. But I don't think India would get into any kind of an objection saying that you can't build it. That is not how it works, in the international relations. But India would bilaterally want to build good ties with all the countries in the Caucasus. That's what it is.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Meena Singh Roy from Delhi for being on the program. She's a senior fellow and head of West Asia and Central Asia Teletoma Foundation. Thank you for being on the program, Miss. Now, let's see what people around the world had to say.
Jora tweeted, Indian Defense Ministry confirms that Armenia bought 307-piece, the indigenous advanced towed artillery gun system, 155mm-52 caliber, from India. Indian Aerospace Defense News wrote, reports, India in talks with Armenia and Iran for a new trade route to Russia and Europe. Iran and Armenia are already building a transit road bypassing Azerbaijan. Vermedia tweeted, Armenia and India are negotiating the signing of a bilateral agreement on international road transport. Yerevan also considers the connection of New Delhi to the Persian Gulf Black Sea International Transport Corridor possible.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Since the U.S. sanctions on Russia, the de-dollarization trend is gaining momentum. Many countries are slowly shifting towards local currencies for international trade transactions in order to reduce their dependency on the U.S. dollar. Just recently, India's Ministry of External Affairs announced that India and Malaysia can now conduct trade using the Indian rupee as a mode of settlement in addition to other currencies. This development comes as India seeks to insulate its trade from the impact of the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict and its subsequent fallout.
On the first of this month, the Indian Ministry of External Affairs issued a statement saying that trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in Indian rupee, in addition to the current modes of settlement in other currencies. This follows the decision by the Reserve Bank of India in July 2022 to allow the settlement of international trade in Indian rupee. This initiative by the Reserve Bank of India is aimed at facilitating the growth of global trade and support the interests of the global trading community in Indian rupees. Union Bank of India has become the first bank in India to implement this option. The Indian Bank has opened a special rupee Vostra account in partnership with the International Bank of Malaysia. The Indian government has already permitted banks from 18 countries, including Malaysia, to open special rupee Vostra accounts to settle payments in the Indian currency. A press release by the Union Bank of India stated, This move will enable Indian and Malaysian traders to invoice trade in Indian rupees and obtain better pricing for goods and services traded. This mechanism is expected to benefit traders on both sides, as they can directly trade in Indian rupee and save on currency conversion spreads.
Malaysia has fortified its bilateral economic and commercial relations with India, making it India's third largest trading partner in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, and the 13th largest trading partner overall. In turn, India ranks amongst Malaysia's top 10 largest trading partners. However, much of the exchange between the two nations has been conducted in the US dollars, which has resulted in additional expenses for the businesses. The transaction to local currencies is expected to decrease such costs and stimulate greater trade and investment.
India and Malaysia's trade and investment ties have a long-standing history, and in recent years, bilateral trade has been growing consistently. The bilateral trade volume in the April to November period of 2022 reached a staggering $13.86 billion, with Malaysia's investments in India reaching an approximate amount of $7 billion. India's primary exported items to Malaysia consist of petroleum products, organic chemicals, iron and steel, nuclear reactors, boilers, and electrical equipment, while its imports include animal or vegetable fats and oils, mineral fuels, mineral oils and products, and petroleum. Over 150 Indian companies, including 61 joint ventures, are operating in Malaysia across various sectors, such as textiles, drugs and pharmaceuticals, specialty chemicals, biotechnology, and healthcare. India has been endeavoring to advance the use of the Indian rupee in international trade settlements, and the agreement with Malaysia represents a significant stride in this direction. India has inked similar agreements with Iran, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates. The agreement is likely to encourage other nations in the region to pursue similar arrangements, boosting economic relations and lessening dependence on the U.S. dollar in international trade and finance.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by economist Mr. Sayed Javed Hassan from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, India and Malaysia have recently agreed to conduct trade using the Indian rupee as a mode of settlement. So how is this going to impact their bilateral trade relations?
There are a number of benefits in using the domestic currency, the local currency, which is rupee, Indian rupee in this case. First of all, it will reduce the transaction costs. You know, converting from dollar to rupee, converting to dollar to the Malaysian currency, they all increase the transaction costs. As the transaction costs reduce, the amount of trade will increase, so it increases the efficiency of trading. It also reduces reliance on US dollars. So this increases the economic independence for both Malaysia and for India. Moreover, given that the currency fluctuations against dollars can be quite extreme, this also reduces the fluctuations in trade between the two countries. So it brings about greater stability. Moreover, it will also increase India's ability to increase investments from Malaysia once more and more Indian rupees are used for trade. So it has a huge impact in terms of economic and political ties, and also will increase overall trade.
Mr. Hassan, the use of local currencies in the international trade is on the rise. So to what extent will it lead to a shift in the balance of power between the U.S. and other states?
There's about 60% of global foreign exchange reserves are in dollars. Something like 40 to 50% of global trade is done in dollars. So dollars, U.S. dollars are obviously one of the most, it is the most dominant currency. This gives United States an enormous power, both in terms of economics as well as in terms of politics. Now, what we are seeing is more and more use of local currencies. There's seen between China and Brazil. We have seen recently talk between United States and China and Saudi Arabia. These are beginning to happen. And one of the reasons is basically people want greater degree of independence. They don't want to have to be dependent on the U.S. as much. It also is very often driven by local economic and geopolitical factors. So if countries are very close together, they tend to find it much more easy to use their local currencies. And finally, I think there is the fear of sanctions in the case of especially China. There's a fear that at some point the United States might flex its political muscle and use the dollar to sanction it.
Mr. Hassan, recently we've seen India is pushing to advance the use of the India rupee in the international trade. So how will this strategy benefit India in the coming years?
There are a number of benefits that India gets from increasing use of Indian rupee. First of all, it reduces the reliance, as I've already mentioned, on the U.S. dollars. It provides a level of economic independence. It also reduces, as I've also mentioned, the fluctuations, the wild fluctuations you can sometimes get in USD, which has an effect on local inflation. So once you start using the domestic currencies bilaterally, you tend to have much more stable exchange, greater efficiency, and also the level of impact on inflation is reduced. So that's one of the benefits. The other benefit, obviously, is internationalization of the Indian rupee will help in terms of foreign investments into India. As more and more countries own rupees, they would want to look to invest into India using those rupees. It also increases India's access to international capital markets, because as Indian rupee becomes a much more accepted form of currency, they will be able to issue bonds in terms of Indian rupees.
There you have it, Mr. Syed Javed Hassan, economist from Islamabad. Thank you for your time and knowledge, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
S.L. Canton tweeted, "No more U.S. dollar needed in India-Malaysia trade. Indian rupee can now be used for imports and exports." Interestingly, it all started with U.S. and EU sanctions on Russia. In order to buy Russian oil, coal, fertilizer, etc., the Indian Central Bank created special Vostro accounts to circumvent U.S. dollar last year. Once that was successful, it was easy to copy-paste the mechanism elsewhere. Now, 18 countries, including UK and Germany, are working on implementing this type of settlement. Deepak Kapoor, IAS, wrote, "Malaysia, first country in ASEAN area which will do trade with India in rupee, our currency. Jai Hind." Red Pill tweeted, "India, Malaysia ditched the dollar to trade in Indian rupee." Noah wrote, "So over in Econ Twitter, apparently India has ditched the US dollar in its cross-border trade relations. Malaysia has become one of the first countries that agreed to conduct trade deals with India using rupee. Iran is also looking to follow India's example."
And that was our episode about India's relation with the South Caucasus countries and also the rupee emerging as a trading currency between India and Malaysia. We shall meet again. Take great care.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. We'll be right back.
In the Limelight.
The U.S. military has claimed that it has permission to arrest people without charge and only on basis of being a suspect, to keep prisoners in detention indefinitely, particularly at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The New York Times has covered this story and tells us more. A human rights panel of the United States has demanded the immediate release of Guantanamo prisoner Abu Zubaydah, who has been tortured by the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention urged the United States to release Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainal Abidin Muhammad Hussein, from the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which is based within a U.S. Navy military base at Guantanamo Bay. The notorious prison was established by then-U.S. President George W. Bush in 2002 to hold foreign terrorism suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks in New York. Abu Zubaydah, now 52 years old, was captured in a raid in Pakistan just 2 months after the establishment of Guantanamo Bay detention camp and has been held there without charge since 2006. He's the first detainee to be waterboarded by the CIA after the 9/11 events. The United Nations panel said that after studying other cases at Guantanamo over the past 15 years, it had seen a pattern that could constitute crimes against humanity. Washington claims that although Abu Zubaydah, born in Saudi Arabia, was never a member of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group, he has been held indefinitely in the so-called war against terrorism because he allegedly helped militants reach Afghanistan for training before the 9/11 attacks. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which has no enforcement mechanism, also found that Abu Zubaydah had been denied a meaningful review of his detention and hence was being held against the law. The United Nations panel said in an opinion, the appropriate remedy would be to release Mr. Zubaydah immediately, and it accord him an enforceable right to compensation and other reparations in accordance with international law. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the same story and tells us more. Abu Zubaydah was the first prisoner of a CIA black site, a global network of overseas secret prisons that held over 100 men beyond the reach of US law and the International Committee of the Red Cross from 2002 through to 2006. Two CIA contract psychologists devised a torture program of enhanced interrogation techniques specifically for use on him in an agency prison in Thailand, in which he was waterboarded, deprived of sleep, and confined in a coffin-like box. The panel said, in July of 2002, the Central Intelligence Agency acquired approval for the use of 10 enhanced interrogation techniques on Mr. Abu Zubaydah: attention grasp, walling, facial hold, insult slap, cramped confinement, exacerbating phobias, wall standing, stress positions, prolonged sleep deprivation, and the waterboard technique. It added that the torturers reportedly subjected Abu Zubaydah to ice baths, forced nudity, and sexual violence. Methods were tested on him that had never been discussed. The panel also lambasted 5 other countries where the U.S. held Abu Zubaydah, that is, Afghanistan, Thailand, Poland, Morocco, and Lithuania. In 2018, the European Court of Human Rights condemned Lithuania and Romania for their complicity in the CIA torture program. The United Nations also censured the complicity of the United Kingdom, whose spy agencies had U.S. interrogators question Abu Zubaydah at black sites despite its knowledge of his extreme mistreatment. Back in 2019, Abu Zubaydah drew some sketches of how he was tortured. His lawyers made the sketches public, triggering an outcry from human rights groups across the world. The infamous U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, which was supposed to be a temporary detention center and never meant to be a permanent prison, was chosen because of its ambiguous legal status. It is under full control of the U.S. military and relatively close to the mainland United States, but beyond the reach of American courts, thus allowing detainees to be held indefinitely outside of normal laws or judicial oversight. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered the same story. The International Committee of the Red Cross has unveiled foreign inmates who had been held captive for many years without trial in the U.S. military prison and torture facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba are showing signs of accelerated aging. The International Committee of the Red Cross's head of delegation for the United States and Canada, Patrick Hamilton, said, "We're calling on the U.S. administration and Congress to work together to find adequate and sustainable solutions to address these issues." Patrick Hamilton added, "Action should be taken as a matter of priority." Most of the violations at Guantanamo were attested by numerous U.S. military officers appointed to represent the inmates in courts of law, with very limited access to legal resources and classified documents to adequately defend the inmates or make a legal case against U.S. military and spy agencies involved in the illegal capture and imprisonment of most of the captives held at Guantanamo. Patrick Hamilton said he was struck by how those who are still detained today are experiencing the symptoms of accelerated aging, worsened by the cumulative effects of their experiences and years spent in detention. The senior International Committee of Red Cross official called for detainees to receive adequate mental and physical health care and more frequent family contact, basic rights that U.S. military has brutally refrained to provide for the Guantanamo prisoners. Without elaborating, a Pentagon spokesperson claimed the U.S. Defense Department is currently reviewing the report. Recently, the oldest inmate at Guantanamo, Saifullah Paracha, has been released to his home country of Pakistan after 19 years of detention at Guantanamo. Like most prisoners at Guantanamo, the Pakistani businessman was never formally charged and had little legal power to challenge his detention. The appalling treatment of the foreign captives at Guantanamo came to symbolize the excesses of the purported U.S. war on terror because of harsh interrogation and torture methods widely censured by critics. This is why the U.S. government, which regularly drafts and widely publicizes numerous reports judging and censuring other countries on their human rights observance, has allowed very limited access to the Guantanamo detention facility for international inspectors. Moreover, most Western human rights organizations, such as the British-based Amnesty International and the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch, have kept mostly silent on the horrendous treatment of foreign captives at Guantanamo Bay, as well as foreign refugees, by border guards in the U.S. and other Western countries. The United States and Britain have been key players in the brutal military invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and are on record for committing enormous atrocities while occupying the war-torn countries for many years. There were still 40 inmates left in the Guantanamo prison when current U.S. President Joe Biden took office in 2021. The Biden administration has claimed it wants to close the infamous facility, but has never presented a plan for doing so. The previous Democratic administration of Barack Obama also made a similar pledge, when Obama was sworn into office in 2008, but also failed to do so. Patrick Hamilton urged Washington to resolve.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, how closing the ears of our hearts has a negative effect upon our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are humbly speaking about how closing the ears of our hearts has a negative impact and a negative effect on our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. Now, we find, dear friends, that the divine messengers of the past, the divine prophets of the past, and of course the divinely appointed imams, they all were sent in order to help us attain a pure and complete and perfect form of ubudiyya. Now, despite the fact that these divinely appointed messengers came to teach us all these beautiful ways to attain a perfect and complete ubudiyya, which has positive results both for us in this material world as well as the hereafter, unfortunately, some people, if not many people, decided to close their ears at that time, and even in the present time, we find that many people have decided to close their ears. Now, not only have people decided to close the ears of their head, their physical ears, but they have also decided to close the ears of their hearts. And so neither are people willing to listen to this divine message that has been sent by the Almighty Allah, physically via their ears, but even within their hearts, individuals do not want to accept that message in their hearts. So when we talk about the ears of the heart, of course we are talking about this acceptance to believe, this will to accept the truth. These are what is meant by the ears of the heart, right? So when the heart listens, it is accepting, almost involuntarily, but then after the heart listens to the message, right, without putting obstacles and barriers in order to prevent that message from having an impact, after this is crossed, then of course the heart will begin to accept voluntarily what it has received. And so the divine messengers appointed by the Almighty Allah, they were sent for us to be able to attain this perfect and complete form of ubudiyya, service, worship, and obedience to the Almighty Allah. And so we, for some reason, decide to close the ears of our hearts. And then, of course, what happens is that this message sent by the Almighty Allah via these divine messengers has no effect on us. And of course, it has no effect on us because we have decided to close not only our physical ears, but we have also decided to close the metaphysical ears of our heart. We have decided to put up barriers in front of this message so that this message does not come to us. And so inadvertently, we become our own greatest enemy.
Dear brothers and sisters, have you ever reflected on the blessing of your ears? Your ears are in charge of collecting sounds, processing them, and sending sound signals to your brain. And that's not all. Your ear also helps you keep your balance. So if you bend over to pick up something, you won't fall down. The ear is made up of three different sections: the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. These parts all work together so that you can hear and process sounds. Just think about your hearing for a second. The deaf person doesn't have the blessing of hearing the beautiful recitation of the Quran, or listening to a heart-moving lecture, or even hearing his own voice. Those of us who do have the blessing of hearing, how do we use this great gift? Do we listen to music? Do we listen to gossip? All good things that come our way and that we often take for granted come from Allah. May Allah give us the chance to express our gratitude and thankfulness for all the blessings He has granted us and to utilize them in the best way. Now, what we talked about till now was the physical ear which Allah has granted us. But in the Quran and Ahadith, we read that there is also a spiritual ear which gives us the power to perceive things beyond the sounds of the concrete world around us. Imam al-Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "You have a heart and ears to hear." And verily, if Allah wants to guide a servant, He will open the ears of his heart. And if He wills the opposite, He will seal the ears of his heart so that it will never again be sound. This is what Allah means in the verse, "Or are there locks on their hearts?" Let's get to know more about this aspect in the words of Hujjatul Islam, Tawakkul.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ear and the ability of hearing is one of the most precious blessings from God. This blessing is not ours and belongs to God. As God says in Surah Yunus, verse 31, أَمَّنْ يَمْلِكُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارِ, who is the one who owns the hearing and sights? Meaning that just God is the owner of them. When the real owner is God, and it is just entrusted to us, it means that we could not use our hearing in any way we desire. We have to use our hearing just exactly as the owner of it, who is God, permits. Most of our problem is resulted of a wrong notion that we think what we have belongs to us, and it is ours, we are the owner, and we are free to use them. But this is not the case. If we use our ear and our hearing ability in a wrong way, or hearing in the day of judgment will testify against us. Also, we have to be careful that sometimes some people do not use their hearing to listen to godly advice and to accept it, and as a result, God will set a seal on their ears, and consequently, they would not find the right path. As God says in the Quran, خَتَمَ اللَّهُ عَلَىٰ قُلُوبِهِمْ وَعَلَىٰ سَمْعِهِمْ, Allah sets a seal on their hearts and are they hearing, and as a result, they could not be benefited from them. God be with you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير
أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير
يا الله يا رحمن
حقق أمانينا
Welcome back, dear listeners. So in continuation to what we were humbly speaking about was how some people, if not most people, have a tendency to close the physical ears that they have as well as the metaphysical ears of their hearts to the message of Allah, and of course how this has a huge negative impact and effect on our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah. So we were saying how some people, and perhaps even it can be said that most people, you know, they end up creating barriers so that the divine message of the Almighty Allah does not reach them, so that their heart does not hear that message, and so that their heart does not accept that message. We end up putting so many powerful barriers within ourselves and outside of ourselves, that the admonitions and the advice and the warnings of these divine messengers, they have no effect on us. And even worse, it can get to a point where even the ayahs and the verses and the chapters of the Holy Quran, as well as the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, they do not pierce through the veils of the ears of our hearts. And so, to a certain extent, even if this message of the Holy Quran and the sayings of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, even if these things go into our physical ears that are on our head, they do not reach our heart, they do not reach the depths of our soul. And of course, there's various different things that create obstacles when it comes to be able to receive this divine message from the Almighty Allah. Now, whether that is, you know, material wealth, whether it is, greed for material wealth, whether it is greed for worldliness, whether it is power or fame or fortune, any kind of lust for carnal desires, women and the like, for example, or even if it is a kind of love that an individual has which is in competition with the love for Allah. These are all things that are obstacles: our selfishness, our greed, our jealousy, our, you know, hate, which is a selfish hate, a personal hate, right? Just as a tangent, we find that in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, hating for the sake of Allah and loving for the sake of Allah, both are worship. But when it comes to a personal vendetta, you know, these are not acceptable. And so these are all things that are barriers, right, that come in the way of our ubudiyah when it comes to the Almighty Allah. And unless we remove these barriers one by one, we allow this divine message of the Almighty Allah to reach the depths of our heart and the depths of our soul, of course there will be no ubudiyah, and that is the most dangerous and the worst possible condition for a human being to be in. And so please remember to open the ears of not only your head, but the ears of your hearts, in order to be able to attain that perfect and complete ubudiyah, that service, worship, and obedience to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Allah, la ilaha siwa, la tu-
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a program that takes you on a journey through Africa. We cover current affairs in the continent and also highlight various aspects of the continent's rich history, culture, and civilization. In our program today, we are focusing on the standoff between Tunisia and the International Monetary Fund over a bailout package. In the second part of our program, we are discussing impunity by Western countries that are exporting toxic pesticides to Africa and thus endangering the lives of people across the continent. So stay with us.
Tunisia rejects the IMF diktats. Tunisia continues to face economic woes 12 years after its revolution, which was fueled by economic discontent. Administrations that came to power over the past decade have failed to resolve the country's economic challenges. Experts have warned that the adherence to the counterproductive austerity measures dictated by the International Monetary Fund, that's the IMF, are the main source of economic dissatisfaction.
Tunisia's bailout talks with the IMF have stalled for months, with the United States and other Western donors demanding far-reaching reforms from the government of President Kais Saied to free up the cash. Now, the IMF is demanding the Tunisian government eliminate subsidies on energy and food, which have been in place for several decades to assist poor families in the country. President Kais Saied has categorically rejected these demands, saying he will not accept any external diktat that increases poverty in the country.
Regarding the International Monetary Fund, foreign diktats that will lead to more poverty are unacceptable. The alternative is to rely on ourselves and work on our own. Just like in the past, lifting subsidies will only cause chaos. Social peace is not a game.
Now, for more on the standoff between the IMF and Tunisia, we have contacted Hannah Rader. She's the Chief Executive Officer of Development Reimagined. Thanks, madam, for your time today. Now, as we have heard there, President Kais Saied rejected the terms of a stalled $1.9 billion IMF bailout package and suggested that subsidy cuts could lead to unrest. Do you agree with this justification?
Yes, look, I think there is ample evidence these days that the policies that have been promoted from IMF programs, which typically have fiscal consolidation at their core, are not working and haven't worked for countries for a very long time. In the 1980s and 1990s, we had something called structural adjustment programs, which were promoted from the World Bank and the IMF. And today, we still have ongoing programs, but while they don't have the same label, the underlying view, the underlying economic implication is of fiscal consolidation, or basically reducing the government spending. And when governments reduce spending, for example, on fuel subsidies or on food subsidies, that of course will lead to unrest, and there will be significant challenges. And in fact, the IMF themselves have recently come out with a study saying that fiscal consolidation, reducing government spending, does not even lead to a reduction in the debt-to-GDP ratios.
Tunisia emerged from the so-called Arab Spring as a beacon of democracy, but has been grappling with economic hardships. Many Tunisians complained about the cost of living, despite a government directive capping the cost of basic goods during a recent holy month of Ramadan.
Making a living has become very difficult, and what makes it more difficult is a shortage in basic commodities. We can't buy what we want, so we only buy what we can buy.
Tunisia is still highly dependent on Europe economically, and in particular, France, the former colonial power. While Tunisia regained independence in 1956, the legacy of colonialism is still evident in this North African country. The imperial economic models, whereby colonial economies were structured to meet the needs of the colonized, continue to dominate this country. This dependency is viewed as a major factor behind Tunisia's economic problems.
While Arab Spring was, as you say, a beacon of democracy, the post-Arab Spring period in Tunisia did lead to a decline in economic development. And it was not only because of its own location and its own domestic challenges, but also because Tunisia at that point and even today still has a significant dependency on Europe for its exports. And the decline in Europe due to the financial crisis in 2008 created challenges in terms of demand for Tunisian exports. And so that made it very difficult to boost economic growth. So the progress after Arab Spring was really quite slow in terms of trying to increase Tunisia's economic growth rate and also to diversify out of that kind of dependency on Europe.
Now, one of the outstanding principles of Tunisian politics under President Kais Saied is the rejection of foreign interference. Now, this stance has been repeated throughout the current negotiations with the IMF. Now, why are foreign powers and institutions interfering in Tunisia's internal affairs?
They feel, these other creditors feel, that they need to kind of impose their own view as to what the country should do. They, in a sense, whether democratically elected or not, they will not trust those leaders to necessarily do the right thing, and they feel that they have to impose. And I think that is a real challenge which these institutions find themselves in. Is that it also means that changing the governance and the way that these institutions are run is really crucial, because the only way that kind of voice can be shifted is by having more low and middle income countries' representation to be able to push that kind of interference away. And that's the thing. These are principles of non-interference, principles of no conditionality, are principles which are held by many low and middle income countries, but they're not necessarily accepted by certain other countries, whether it's US or Europe, European region. They have a much bigger challenge with understanding where those principles come from. So it is a struggle. I've described it as a struggle, a grand struggle, in some of my writing. And this kind of struggle is something that Tunisia is involved in, but it's not just an issue which is related, it's just for Tunisia. It's